book of Esther begins with an account of the king of Persia rejecting his queen. And I've heard different stories as to how that took place or what it was that may have happened that caused that. But the bottom line is to us, Esther was a Jew who was chosen in her place, chosen to be considered in the place of the queen. And she became the central character in that story in which describes the deliverance of the Jews. But there's something I think sometimes we pass by. We look at Haman, you know, and we look at Mordecai, and we look at how the story plays out. But in the beginning of the story, there is an illustration upon which everything else hinges, and on which that first element had to take place before the story could follow. I'd like to turn to the book of Esther. Starting in chapter 2, we read of the decree of the king Ahasuerus, and what he had, he says, he remembered Vashti in verse 1 and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. It says, the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, unto the women's quarters, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women. And let beauty preparations be given them. And then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. And now notice verse number 8. So it was, when the king's command and decree was heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, that Esther was also taken to the king's palace. Now understand, that was a different culture and it was a different place, but she might have had dreams and hopes for her future. She may have had someone in her mind that she looked to and hoped for in terms of her own marriage and her life. She would have had plans and purposes by this point in her life, and yet she was taken from that and taken to the king's palace under the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women, and notice her attitude and approach and her response. In spite of what we would look at as a very severe circumstance. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. All the story that follows hinges on this event, that she obtained favor because of her attitude and approach. Now, God obviously had a hand in that. We see how the story plays out. But Esther had a hand in it as well. God didn't just do this to her, he did it through her. He worked through Esther to gain favor in the eyes of those that she became responsible to. In the Bible, this type of circumstance plays out over and over again. Sometimes we pray to God and we ask him, please bless me in this way, intercede for me in this way, help me. And yet God shows over and over that we have a part in that to play. That he does grant us favor, but it is favor based on the attitude and approach that we exude and that we portray. Look at the book of Ezra. We see, again, a number of these circumstances that play out over and over again. Going back here just a little bit. Ezra 7, starting in verse number 7. Ezra here is going to go to Jerusalem, back to Jerusalem, to help restore the area there, the temple, ultimately the city. In time, one after another of God's servants would return to see that that process was complete. But in verse number 7, it says, some of the children of Israel, the priests, the Levites, the singers, the gatekeepers, the Nethinim, came up to Jerusalem in the 7th year of King Artaxerxes. Those individuals who would have specific responsibilities in restoration of the temple area and of the city then that would follow. And Ezra came to Jerusalem in the 5th month, which was in the 7th year of the king. On the first day of the first month, he began his journey from Babylon. On the first day of the 5th month, he came to Jerusalem according to the good hand of his God upon him. says that God blessed him, God's hand was on him. But why? At least in part, why? Verse 10. For Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord and to do it, and to teach statutes and ordinances in Israel. So he set his mind and his heart to serve God, and God then in turn blessed him and gave him favor. And if we go on to verse 23, we break into the middle of the letter that Artaxerxes sent with him to buy him, in that sense, favor by his instructions. Whatever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it diligently be done for the house of the God of heaven. For why should there be wrath against the realm of the king and his sons? Also, we inform you that it shall not be lawful to impose tax or tribute or custom on any of the priests or Levites, the singers or gatekeepers, the Nethinim or servants of this house of God. And you, Ezra, according to your God-given wisdom. Think about that. You, Ezra, according to your God-given wisdom. Do you think Ezra had something to do with that as well, or did God simply lay that over the top of him? Isn't wisdom something we exercise? And if it's God-given, then he had to give evidence of where he indeed learned those things and who he represented in that way. According to your God-given wisdom, set magistrates and judges who may judge all the people who are in the region beyond the river, all such as know the laws of your God, and teach those who do not know them. Very, very big responsibility. Whoever will not observe the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be executed speedily on him, whether it be death or banishment or confiscation of goods or imprisonment. You know, you delegate authority, if you have authority, to somebody you believe absolutely will carry it through and be responsible with it. Even unto death, banishment, confiscation of goods or imprisonment. And in verse number 27, Ezra now speaks, Blessed be the Lord God of our fathers, who has put such a thing as this in the king's heart, to beautify the house of the Lord which is in Jerusalem, and has extended mercy to me before the king and his counselors, and before all the king's mighty princes. So I was encouraged, as the hand of the Lord my God was upon me, and I gathered chief men of Israel to go up with me. Think of Ezra and his attitude and approach as simply being fruitful in response to God's lead using his Holy Spirit, of bearing much fruit, of having God-given wisdom. His counsel to the king, the actions in his life had to have some way borne witness of this. You know, think about that. Let's say you come into a sum of money and you have to invest it in some way. And you go to a financial advisor and he's broke. How much trust are you going to put in your financial advisor if he's broke? I don't think you would probably use him. I have a friend, my wife and I have a friend who is a church member who years back had radiation treatment because of cancer that she had. And the doctor burned her badly and damaged her in the radiation. And after the fact, it found out that there were other people under that doctor that had been injured in treatment as well. And in the course of the lawsuits that were building, the doctor left the United States. We completely out of country back home where nobody could get at him. You know, would you go to that doctor if he'd stayed and said, would you help me too? We go to people that have succeeded in those things that they do. You know, I remember when we moved into Texas for the first time and we had a real estate agent we'd connected in advance, and I remember looking at her car when she drove up to pick us up for the first time. It was okay, and we figured we'll give it a try. Can you imagine if she drove up in some broken down old jalopy that couldn't even be fixed? I'd say, you know, this is definitely a very successful person. I think I'll put my trust in them. When you see Ezra here, a letter by the king saying, look, I give you authority even unto death to administer in my government in this way. It shows that the favor that Ezra had came obviously by God's hand in part. But it came as well by Ezra's part also, by what he had done as well in response to God's lead. Obtaining favor is an important part of our service to God. And by favor with man, I'm not talking about compromising with man, but I'm talking about dealing with men in such a way that indeed they respond in a positive manner. Very, very important. Esther did it. Ezra did it. Nehemiah was able to do it as well. It's nice to think that all we need to do is stand for the truth, raise our hand in the air, and then speak out and offend all of humanity. And it need not always be so. I'm not saying that will never take place, but that obviously need not be so. Nehemiah chapter 1 and verse number 1 says, the words of Nehemiah came to pass in the month of Chislev in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the citadel, that Hanani, one of my brethren, came with men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down. The gates are burned with fire. And so it was when I heard these words that I sat down and wept, and I mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. So again, we see his attitude and approach, much like Ezra's, crying out to God and seeking his will. But notice the first verse of chapter 2. Nehemiah is the cupbearer to the king. The cupbearer to the king is not a waiter or an orderly. It is a personal aide that in some ways, in that sense, has the life of the king in his hand. A very responsible position that requires wisdom. It requires socially responsible behavior and manner. It requires a presence of being able to stand in front of the mighty leaders of that day and do so in an honorable manner. It says, it came to pass in the month of Nisan, not in the month of the car, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was set before him, that I took the wine and I gave it to the king. Now I had never been sad in his presence before. He had fulfilled his role over a period of time, risen to power and authority in the kingdom, and he says, I had never been sad in his presence. I think that's a remarkable statement, and we read over it very, very quickly. But we go on to see that Nehemiah also had great honor and favor in the eyes of the king because of his manner, because of the way that he represented himself and his God. Therefore the king said to me, why is your face sad since you are not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of heart, and I became dreadfully afraid. And said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste, its gates are burned with fire? Then the king said to me, what do you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. So the king said to me, the queen there sitting with him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Furthermore, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river, that they must permit me to pass through till I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest. Notice again the degree of favor that Nehemiah had here with the king. A letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he must give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel, which pertains to the temple, for the city wall, and for the house that I will occupy. And the king granted them to me according to the good hand of my God upon me. Time and time again, God works through the favor that has been given to his servants. Now, I know there's other examples as well. But that favor does not come in spite of us. It comes through us. God doesn't land it on top of us. He works indeed in our mind and heart. And then the favor is granted in response to the relationships that we maintain and the way we handle ourselves and those things that we have done and learned to do and we apply in our lives according to how fruitful we are in response to God's lead. You know, if in this life we don't go and get an education, or we don't develop job-related skills, or we don't learn to dress respectfully or speak responsibly or mix socially, if we do not learn to do those things, what is God supposed to do? Is He supposed to grant us favor anyway? If we are the wine steward, the cupbearer, the aide, and we spill our wine on the king, will he be happy anyway? Will he be happy no matter what we have done? He absolutely will not. And so when we look at Esther and Ezra and Nehemiah and others, we see individuals responding to the lead of God in their lives in a certain way. God working through them, but they very much have a part to play as well. Look at Daniel. Again, we see this over and over and over again. Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. And then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel, some of the king's descendants, and some of the nobles. Young men. Now look at the description of the type of individuals that were chosen. Young men in whom there was no blemish, good looking. All right, so I could not have served in that capacity. Gifted in all wisdom. It wasn't just a matter that they were pleasing in their presentation in that way. Gifted in wisdom. What is wisdom? Is it just knowledge or is it not application? If somebody says, I know the answer to that, but they don't apply it, do we really think they know the answer? It's not enough. It comes through application. So here are young people recognized for the way they live their lives and the understanding they have and the way they present themselves. Possessing knowledge, quick to understand. I was listening to Bill O'Reilly yesterday driving down on an errand somewhere, and he says he's never smoked dope and he's never been drunk. And I think that's what he said. And he said, now this, again, these are his words, but he says, my mind is sharper than those who have. He says, as a result, I can't remember what the rest of it was he said. No. We obviously came from different backgrounds. But he was making his argument. He says, there's some things you don't do because even as a kid I could see that they would hurt my brain, my mind, my ability to process. And he says, I'm fast, I can think things, I can remember things, I can relate. And I thought, good for you. There's hope for the rest of us. But the point was, here we have individuals who, when they were young, had the wisdom and the sharpness to say, I don't want to do some of those things. I'm not going to damage myself. And they had favor in the eyes of the king because they were successful, even in their youth, in what they were doing. Who had the ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies, of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Now for among those were the sons of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. You know what's interesting? They were all friends. They had personal relationships, and they were all high quality and high caliber individuals, and they strengthened each other in that way. To them, the chief of the eunuchs gave names. Daniel he called Belshazzar, Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, to Azariah, Abednego. And you know the story of their obedience and their faithfulness later on in the book of Daniel. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. And you can say, well, not just defile himself, but that he might not ruin, in part, his potential to function at a very high level. I joke, and it's a half of a joke, but it's half true. I wonder how much I could actually have accomplished if I had my whole brain. You know, if I had not fried part of it, I just wonder how much could I have really done in this life. Now, God had brought Daniel into the favor and the goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. So God had a hand in that, but he did not have a hand in it apart from Daniel. He had a hand in it through Daniel because of his own choices and his own behavior. That favor was in part generated by Daniel as well and his friends, which at times got them into trouble, but as that trouble played out, they received back again to honor again. Probably nobody here is a Daniel. He's a very unique and remarkable individual. I'm not talking in terms of potential in our kingdom of God, but I'm talking as a specific individual, a very, very unique person. But we still serve God. We serve God according to our gifts, and we serve God according to the fruit that we bear. You know, we had Speakers Club here 2 weeks ago. I think Greg and Nancy are off on a trip, and they were at the club that time. Some people get up in that club, and it is hard to even stand behind the lectern and begin to speak. They struggle. And other people will get up who have spoken time and time and time again. And for them, it's not a matter of it's difficult to speak, but they strive then to refine the gifts and abilities that they do have. And one individual who was in club the months before got up and gave what would have been a fine speech under most normal circumstances, but it wasn't as good as that person honestly could do, and Greg Check asked if he wouldn't give it over again. Now that's an interesting process, isn't it? Somebody who got up and did fairly well was asked to get up, please, and do it over again. And he got up this last time and gave an absolutely fine example of a speech. I just, you know, when you're done, hit the bell. This one is it. It was very, very encouraging to see. So we all work according to the gifts and the abilities that we have. And we're measured in according to the fruit that we bear. But we all have our part to play. I was baptized when I was 23 years old. And at that point in my life, I kind of came to learn that most everything I'd been doing and everything that I valued and all the things that I had processed in my mind had to basically be washed away and I had to start over. God was able to use many of those negative experiences that I had had, but on one condition, that I went forward and went another way, not looked back and held on to the damage that was done. God cannot use us if we're holding on to the past. It doesn't work because you can't fix the past. You can't change the past. Megan came in this morning. Dad, I had a dream last night. I dreamed about Brad. I said, well, honey, I'm glad that you're thinking of him and that he's in your mind and someday we get to see him again. But I don't know where he is. But I still go forward. I can't go back. I can't go back and say, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Well, I shouldn't have done that, but I did it. And it's over. And so there's only one thing I can do, and I can do this today. And if I can contribute, I will contribute now, but I cannot go back. So God will use us, and he can use us. He can use all things work together for good. He can take our past and use it for the future and the present if we go that way. But there is no going back. And yet we must learn to present ourselves and to deal with people in such a manner so as to encourage their favor so that we might serve God in that way. You know, think about Esther in the king's harem. Well, I tell you, it'd be easy to have an attitude, I would imagine, being pulled out of your life and into the king's harem, and she gained favor. Daniel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, every one of them were among a captive people taken out of their homes and out of their land. And they received favor. Again, not in spite of them, in part because of them. Look at Hebrews 11. A reminder, verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off and were assured of them, embraced them, and confess that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. They're looking forward to what they indeed will one day have. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. So I went to my 26th translation or whatever it is, New Testament, and I looked up this verse, and one of them, on the, I think it was the Amplified Bible, said, you know, if they'd have been homesick, and if they began to dwell on the past or their previous homeland, then they would have been desirous of going back, going home. And that's what it says. They, if they had called to mind where they had been, if they began to think about that and imagine that and focus on that, then they'd want to go back. He says they would have had opportunity to return, but now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared a city for them. So in the ability for us to go forward in God's service and generate favor so that He might work with us, we do have to walk away and leave the past behind. Esther had to leave her personal life behind, except for her relationship, obviously, in that case, to Mordecai. Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, in various ways, had to leave their past behind. Abraham walked out of his family and away from his home in his calling to serve God. When we are called in serving God, we don't focus on our losses, we focus on our gains. We focus on being fruitful. Matthew 19 describes part of this process of being called into God's service, being willing to go forward and not hang back. Matthew 19, verse 23. Jesus said to his disciples, "Assuredly, I tell you that it's hard for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of heaven. And again, I say to you, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God." Because they had just gone through the circumstance of the rich young ruler who said, "Christ, what should I do?" In other words, what must I do? And Christ said, "Well, obey me, keep the commandments, dedicate yourself to these things, put it first in your life." And it says he was very sorrowful and he went away because he had all these things he was holding on to. Possessions are not the future, it's the accumulation of our past. True treasure is obviously in God's service, doing His will, looking to the kingdom. But His disciples heard it, they were exceedingly amazed and said, "Well, who then can be saved?" Jesus looked at them and said, "With men this is impossible, but with God all things are possible." And Peter answered and said to Him, "See, we have left all and followed You. Therefore, what shall we have?" So Jesus said to them, "Assuredly, I say to you that in the regeneration, when the Son of Man sits on the throne in His glory, you who have followed Me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for My name's sake." Not because you had an attitude, not because you had been evil, not because you made all these mistakes, as in many cases I myself did. It says, "For My name's sake." Because you were committed to God and His service. God says, "Shall receive a hundredfold and inherit everlasting life. But many who are first will be last, and the last first." That's taken in different ways. But in the context of this, I would have to say, at least in part, it is those who are first in this life are not going to be first in God's kingdom or service, because that's not how God rates the fruitfulness of those of the people that He has worked with. So it's an interesting process. Christ reminding them that they will indeed have opportunity, but they need to exercise themselves in a very specific way. God wants to grant us favor, but we have our part to play. In the book of Luke, chapter 2, in verse number 41, talking about Jesus when He was young. And I've always thought this is an interesting example. It's what we would expect, but it's still interesting in this way. His parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. When He was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feast. When they had finished the days, as they returned, the boy Jesus, that sounds funny, doesn't it, the boy Jesus, just the way we use it, lingered behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother didn't know it. But supposing him to have been in the company, they went a day's journey and sought him among their relatives and acquaintances. Now, if you had a child that you couldn't trust out of your sight, and you were constantly having to get back and correct him and bring him back in the line and get his attention back on the task at hand, do you think you'd have waited a day checking among the family to see where he was? No, you'd have checked, you'd have kept him. Have you seen people with their children on a rope in the store? I mean, they got a harness on the child and they got this thing that zips out of a coil. I'm telling you, the kid does not get away. They got him. It's like walking the dog. You got the kid out there and bring him back in. But it says here that, you know, they had to have trusted him enough to know that he was responsible to the point that he would be faithful to their wishes. And so they just assumed he was with the family, and they looked for him along the way. So it says, when they could not find him, they returned to Jerusalem seeking him, and so it was after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking questions. You can understand by now they were distressed. And all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers, so when they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you done this to us? Your father and I have sought you anxiously." And he said to them, "Why is it that you sought me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's business?" But they did not understand the statement which he spoke to them. Again, in this case, this is not the point. The point is in 51 and 52. Then he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject to them. But his mother kept all these things in his heart, and Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and men. By his manner and by his words and by his actions, if you gave him something to do, he would carry through and could be trusted to do it. If he had to babysit the children, or if he had to help build the wall, or if he had to go and run the task and bring home the groceries, so to speak, you could give the man a job and he would do it. And in the course of the way that he responded to the relationships that he had, he grew in favor both with God and with men. So God indeed did bless him, but not in spite of what he did. He blessed him through what he did. And that's a very important distinction, I believe, to make. How do we obtain favor with men in a godly manner? I would address maybe just one basic principle on that today. And that is to esteem others better than ourselves. And I think that is very, very important. If we will esteem others better than ourselves, that will have a fundamental impact on our lives. And I will explain it this way. The more we esteem others, the more respectful to those individuals we will be, and the less judgmental we will be. The more we esteem others, the more we will compliment and encourage those individuals, and the less we would be willing to gossip. Do we ever gossip about someone who we esteem highly? Or do we only gossip about those who we esteem less? We don't want to hurt those who we respect. The more we esteem others, the more forgiving we will be, and the less angry we will be. It is easier to forgive those whom we love and respect, and it is easier to be angry with those who we do not. It simply changes our perspective in a fundamental way. The more value we put on others, the more careful we will be in dealing with them. We'll be more respectful, and we'll be more responsible for them in our relationships. This last week, I stopped at Yokes Market by our house. Well, I guess it was a little bit, a week and a half ago, maybe it was. But as I'm turning around at the end, and you come down to the end of the lot, I was going the way you were supposed to in the traffic, and there was a space at the very end, and there's still a little bit of pile of snow that was left down there, and a little car comes zipping around the corner and just shot right into that space from the other end. And you know, I thought, that's fine, you can have it. Not really. I thought, you know, I ought to just put my car right into the side of yours and just, you know, see if you can even get out. And I drove around the other side, and the gentleman got out apparently with his wife, and they're walking up there, and I'm walking up their side kind of looking over at him, you know. And I had to stop and catch myself because I thought, you know, you poor pathetic thing, me. And the way I have to start doing that sometimes is I have to look at a person and say, you know, you have the potential to be part of the family of God. You could be my brother or my sister. In fact, we may well serve together. One day I might be indeed able to help you in some way. I have to stop and I have to look at the person and remind myself that they're a child of God and their potential, and that actually changes my attitude and approach over time. Maybe not all at once, but at least gives me a way to start to turn the corner. And I have to stop. I have to look at them in another way. I have to begin to esteem them greater than I do. And in doing so, it changes my attitude and approach. If we esteem others greater than ourselves, that does not mean to esteem sin. It does not mean to in some way compromise our beliefs. You don't think that Daniel served a king who was a sinner and an evil man? Or that Ezra and Nehemiah served a king who was a sinner and an evil man? Or Joseph in Egypt? I mean, you can't find some of those individuals that you could hold up and say, indeed, a king of Assyria or Egypt or Babylon, a servant of God. Servant in the sense that God called them to a duty, but not in the sense that their heart was turned to God. And yet those individuals rose up and served them well. And it's a remarkable example. When we watch TV today, what's it full of? Positive things or negative things? I mean full, not just spliced in there in various spots. Put downs and sarcasm and laugh tracks about things that really aren't funny. And it does. It feeds into the back of our mind. Matthew 5 and verse 21. Talks again about the way we look at people and the way we think of them. You've heard that was said to those of old, you shall not murder. Whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Boy, that's a pretty high bar. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council, but whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. Now, instead of trying to figure out what every word means and exactly what the line of authority of that is, the bottom line is that we should be more respectful and more careful in our words and our attitude and approach. We should be more careful about how we think of people and how, indeed, we treat people. And if we're more careful, if we esteem them higher or greater, then we will, indeed, treat them better as well. It will have an impact on our life. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar, go your way, first be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Agree with your adversary quickly while you're on your way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge hand you over to the officer, and you are thrown in prison. Not exactly receiving honor in response. Assuredly, I say to you, you will by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny. So there is a physical reason, but there is a spiritual reason as well. The more we respect others, the more respectful of them we will be. Pretty simple process. Hard to apply at times, but the concept ought to be clear. You know, Matthew 5 and verse 9 says, blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the people who make peace. They shall be called the sons of God. You know, there's people who make peace, and there's people who make war. And then you can tell the difference. You can almost see the black cloud that hangs around over the top of their head as they go from relationship to relationship. But God says, those who make peace, they shall be called the sons of God. Colossians 3, in verse number 12. It says, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercy, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, and long suffering, which means that you will endure and suffer long and you know, in that sense, to put up with injustice and not to retaliate. Bearing with one another, forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against you, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. Not because you're God, but because you're human and you don't need to carry that burden in your heart. It will poison your mind. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. And let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body, and be thankful. You know, when Paul got in a contest with Barnabas over John Mark, and Barnabas said, look, he has potential, and Paul said, I don't want to have anything to do with him. Who was right in that case? It was Barnabas. John Mark later was used, and Barnabas and Paul were able to restore. But in that case, Barnabas, the son of consolation, was right. He says, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord, and whatever you do, in deed or word, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. It's talking about an attitude and approach in which we esteem others greater than ourselves. We put ourselves in a place of, in that sense, their servant, willingly so, and we indeed receive honor and esteem in response. Not so that we can be lifted up, but so that we might use that to serve God better. In the way that Esther did, or Ezra did, or Nehemiah, or Daniel, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The way they did that. Again, you can look at their lives and see other traumas and trials that they went through, but at the same time, in the course of that, they were still lifted up and esteemed and honored for the way that they lived their lives. Romans 12 and verse number 9. Reinforces this very same thing. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. In honor, giving preference to one another. I've had the argument made that indeed this only applies to the church. That we only honor the church. Well, is the king in the church? And it says, honor the king. Who did Daniel honor that was in the church? Or Ezra or Nehemiah? Well, some. But that wasn't exclusive to their attitude and approach. Not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoice in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Is the persecution necessarily going to be in the church? Well, it could be, but I don't think necessarily that's where it will come. It says, bless those who persecute you. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion. All of this is saying, you know, don't think too highly of yourself. But you need to give honor and preference to other people in a right and proper way. Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it's possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. All men. Your neighbors, your friends, those in the community, those in the government. As much as possible, as much as it depends on you, your actions and behavior, live peaceably with all men. Do not avenge yourselves. Give rather place to wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Now it's interesting in verse 20, if your enemy hungers, feed him. If he thirsts, give him a drink, for in so doing you will heap coals of fire on his head. Right. Finally, there's some payback. Well, who heaps the coals? We don't. What do? We give him food when he's hungry, and we give him a drink when he's thirsty. And if in response he's not grateful or responsible, then he will give account to God. But he does not give account to us. So our part is not in judgment, our part is in service. Our part is to esteem him highly. Give him some food. Give him some drink. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. There's another interesting passage in Proverbs 16 that, again, I think ties in and connects to this very close. Proverbs 16 and verse number 7. This is a principle, not a law, but it's a principle that works. When a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. He makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Now, again, you can say, well, I know of a case where that didn't happen. Fine. The case would be true. But the principle is that we can incur favor and honor in the way we respond by thinking highly of others and treating them accordingly, by giving people honor and respect. It does not mean to buy into their sins, but it does mean to treat them in a loving manner, to love your enemies, to treat them as yourself. Think of esteeming others better than ourselves in terms of the fifth commandment, where it says to honor your father and your mother. That's part of that process. That's expressed in the Bible in different places, but Ephesians 6 is where I'll read from it in this case. Ephesians 6 and verse number 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. For your own good, not just to make them happy or make them feel good, for your own good, that it may be well with you, because you will not poison your mind with bitterness and anger and strife. It doesn't say the parents are even always honorable. It doesn't say in any way for you to do a dishonorable thing. It just says to honor, treat them with respect, recognize they have authority, and live within that limit that is placed on you in your service to God, even as a child. But I tell you what, when do our parents cease to be our parents? My mother's 86 or 87, I'd have to check. Years ago, after my dad had died, I remarked to her one time, and I just said, well, you know, I began to remark a little bit about what the past had been. I mean, there were some tough times growing up in our home for various reasons. You know, I remember the days when if you mouthed off, you got the back of the hand, and if you resisted the back of the hand, you got two or three backs of the hands or whatever it took. It was mastery. There's no question about that. When I left home after high school, I despised my father, and I wanted to be anything but like him. And I remember having a big argument with him in his house. His house, I lived there, it wasn't my house, it was his. And I walked out the door. I went over where I was going to live with my friends. And I was there for, I don't remember now, it's been a lot of years, but I was there for a while, a little while. And I came home and to pick up some things to go back and live with my friends. And Dad never really said anything. So I kind of hung around for a few hours. No big issue there. And so I kind of stayed for dinner. Nothing happened, and I spent the night. And kind of without saying anything, I moved back in. Because I didn't really want to leave. I wanted to leave, but I didn't want to leave that way. And he had softened just enough to allow me to be out of place as well and give me a little space. And so I laid it around a few more weeks then living at home until everything seemed to be okay, and then I left and took everything with me. But I just didn't want it to be that way, even in my carnal, foolish flesh. So it just says it's in our interest to be respectful. But what happens as a result? When we honor our parents, then we teach our children to honor us. That's how it works. In fact, we teach our children to honor all of those in authority when we do as well. I made a comment, I said, to my mother one time, reflecting on the past, the way it had been. And I began to make some critical remarks about how we had been raised. And she turned and looked at me and she says, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear it. I dropped it, and I never, ever brought it up again. Never did. Now, you could say, oh, all these things have to be resolved. You got to get it out. We have to talk it out. We have to respond, and we have to deal with this, and it has to be fixed. And well, maybe it does, but show me where that is in the Bible. What's that got to do with forgiveness? And the fact is, I never brought it up again. You know what? I have a great relationship with my mother today. As long as I don't have to be home and tell her what to do. As long as I don't have to go get her out of rehab and take her home with somebody in the house. But she's adjusted and she's accepted that. And you know, when I call her now, there's real joy in her voice that I called to say hello. And she'd be just happy as punch if any of us could come down and see her. But, you know, call her on a pretty regular basis, and we have a great relationship. And you know what? I never did go back and say, you know, I need to fix the time this happened or that happened, or Dad did this or you did that, or the cursing or the anger or the shrill voices or all the stipulations and the rules. And, you know, I never got to go back and fix any of that. I never got to talk to my dad about the time he hit me on the head with a hammer. I never got to fix that. I'd like to say, you know, Dad, don't you think maybe that was a little bit over the top, you know? Well, of course it was over the top. But he died, and I still had a relationship with him that was good. But I didn't get to go back and fix all those things. I didn't get to fix that he was an alcoholic. I didn't get to fix the things that I wanted to do that he wouldn't let us. So the fact that he had polio and didn't go out and do physical things, and when I wanted to go out, I didn't get to do it. Or if he took me hunting, and he carried the gun, and I just walked along and watched him shoot something. Boy, that was fun. You know, I loved my dad when he died. And we had years of great relationships, not because things got fixed, but because things literally got set aside. All right, so they'd take a whole sermon to go through all the possible relationships and what can be done about them. But the bottom line is, think a little less of ourselves. Show a little more respect to others, and we will find that we treat those individuals better because we esteem them more highly, and we will gain favor as a result. That favor will give us peace, in part, in our own mind and heart, but it will also allow us to give service to God in a greater way. Paul, when he went before Felix to make his defense in the book of Acts, what do we think of Paul as? Paul's a firebrand. He's out there fighting with him in the court, you know. He's out there at the temple, and the mob's about to surge up and grab him, and he's accusing those who had turned away from the truth. And Paul says, I always strive to have a conscience without offense toward God and man. That's what Paul said. He says, I wasn't causing trouble in the temple. I came here to worship God. I wasn't accusing anybody. I wasn't causing a problem. I was here trying to worship my God. And if they had anything to accuse me of, why aren't they here with their accusations? He says, I strive to have a conscience without offense toward God and man. If in being accused we are obeying God, then so be it. But let us not be accused of personally causing offense. Let us rather give honor openly and freely, generously and kindly. And in so doing, indeed, we will incur favor with both God and with man.